Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey, I'm Paul Stevenson, and this is episode 109 of VRP Rocks, the ultimate classic rock podcast that says that my music is better than yours. Make sure you subscribe to VRP Rocks on your podcast app right now so you don't miss any of the big name guests that I've got lined up for you, with new VRP Rocks episodes dropping every single Monday. And while you're there, on your app, if it allows you to do so, of course, please leave a quick 5-star review for me, please. It takes, 2 seconds, if that, it really does. And it makes a huge difference to help spread the word of the podcast. I know that you can do it on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and Good Pods and Podcast Addict and probably many others too. So please just click the 5-star button, nothing less than 5 stars, please. And if you've got time, leave a short review as well. I'd be forever grateful. In fact, it can be my kind of early Christmas present from you. So thank you very much for that. On today's episode, then, I speak to a fabulous songwriter and producer whose records have sold 500 million copies worldwide. No joke. He's worked with some of the biggest names in the entire music business, writing so many hit songs that, it would take me the length of this interview just to read them out. So I'm not going to bother. I am, of course, talking about Desmond Child. Now, this was sparked by longtime listener Joey Michaud, who emailed a little while ago asking if we could get some interviews with other people in the rock world, not just the rock stars themselves. I saw that Desmond had a new book out and thought that that would be a great place to start. Living on a Prayer, Big Songs, Big Life is the name of Desmond's book. It's a fascinating read, so many great stories from all the people he's worked with, a lot of personal information in there too. It's available now. I recommend you go and get yourselves a copy. It is a fantastic book. I have read it. Quickly though, before we hear from Desmond, a shout out to a few people who got in touch following last week's episode with brilliant Simon Phillips. Dean Noble messaged saying he loved hearing the stories with Simon, definitely one of his favourite drummers. Jonathan Richard emailed to say he was on the same flight as Simon back in 1996, but was too starstruck to approach him. He wishes he had done now. Jeff Hickman, though, he said he did meet him. Jeff said that he met Simon in New York City a few years back, a class act. It's a highlight of my life. Nicholas Forsland said about Simon joining Toto, he saved the band when he joined, a perfectionist with a clear and distinct sound. Mick Brown said Simon is gifted for sure. Check out Space Boogie by Jeff Beck on the There and Back album. Simon was 23 when he played on that album. It'll blow your mind. Joe Riley loved the interview and said his favourite work of Simon's was his playing with Michael Schenker. And Patrick Langdon said, all this talk of Geddy and Alex getting back together with Rush, I think Simon would be amazing with them. He's so versatile. I agree with that. Huge thanks to everyone that emailed or messaged on social media about the interview with Simon Phillips. If you've not listened yet, please do so. It's a cracker. And always feel free to email me, vintagerockpod@gmail.com, or message me on the socials. I'll give you a mention on next week's show as well. Back to Desmond then, and in this interview you're going to hear so many great tales as he tells all basically about working with Kiss and Aerosmith, Bon Jovi, Joan Jett, Alice Cooper, Bonnie Tyler, there's so more as well in there. Honestly, he's a very entertaining character, a big personality, a lot of fun, and yeah, he's going to tell stories that you're going to love to hear. So please do enjoy this chat with Desmond Child. Now, I'm delighted to be joined by the brilliant songwriter and producer Desmond Child. He's got a brand new book out. It's called Desmond Child, Living on a Prayer, Big Songs, Big Life. Now, Desmond has lived the American dream from rags to riches. People see the credits, they see the songs, they see the people that he's worked with. But this book tells the struggle behind all that. It's deeply personal. He opens up about everything. So we're going to start there, Desmond. How long has this book taken from start to finish? And was it a cathartic experience to get it all down on paper?
My collaborator, David Ritz, and I started the book over 7 years ago. So I call it my 7-year jailhouse confession. I mean, it really was very cathartic, especially, you know, getting down to the real stories. Because, you know, as we go along in life, we rewrite everything to our best look, right? And this time I decided to, you know, actually confess and tell the truth about everything.
And was it difficult to go back? Because obviously your childhood, what was difficult? I mean, you go through all the explanations and the struggles and everything coming from Cuba and the issues around your parents and your mother and your birth father were homophobic and things like that. And you left home at 18 to go to New York. And was it difficult to actually put it down on paper and get it all out there?
It was very painful. I just didn't realize, you know, in the end, looking back, you know, this kind of drive that I have, it kind of explained it. I just wanted so badly to be able to take care of my mother and also to fulfill her dream. She was a songwriter and a poet as well. And she really struggled, but she never stopped working. And, you know, she would work at, you know, fast food chain, you know, during the day and come home at 11:30 at night with the soggy hamburgers and fish sandwiches. We'd put two tops together, you know, to make one dry one. And, you know, she, on weekends, all she did was her music. And then she'd be out in the cabarets and nightclubs pushing her songs to the artists. And she did get cuts, but never made it a penny. Because in those days, you know, it was very difficult not being someone who spoke English. Somebody who had money to afford lawyers to defend her. I mean, all of these things factored into it. So I vowed that I would make things right. And it's something that has driven me. I don't think it's healthy. I don't think it's healthy to live your life trying to live your mother's dream, right?
Well, exactly. And then I said you were 18 when you moved to New York, and it was the dream, wasn't it, to get into music, and you had your own group and things like that, didn't you, from quite a young age?
Yes. I went to NYU, and I had a girlfriend at the time, you know, who she and I started our group, Desmond Child and Rouge, with these other very beautiful, powerful women, Miriam Valley and Diana Grasselli. And we just, you know, hit the streets, putting up our posters, stenciling the sidewalks. We'd play 2 or 3 gigs a week. In fact, we had all the club owners mad at us because they'd open the Village Voice and they would, you know, on the calendar of events, they'd see our name like 3 or 4 times. It's like, how are you going to, you know, bring people into the club if you've spread your audience out over like 3 or 4 gigs? But we all vowed we'd bring 10 people in each. So no matter where we were, we'd have 40 or 50 people every gig because we had diehard fans. So, you know, that those were some of the most exciting, you know, funniest and lovable times of my life.
Yeah, and with that group, you appeared on Saturday Night Live and things like that. But as we said, it's a tale of struggle. You'd be bare your soul all the way through from childhood. But as this is a rock podcast, we're going to focus on some of the huge and incredible names that you've worked with in terms of the rock sphere. And we'll start with the first hit, the first blockbuster that really put you on the map. And it doesn't get much bigger nowadays, thinking back, than Kiss and I Was Made for Loving You. Now, you first met Paul Stanley, I think it says in the book, when he came backstage after one of your shows. Is that correct?
That's right. Desmond Child and Rouge was performing at a little club called Trax, T-R-A-X, on West 72nd Street. You know, it was literally an underground club, underground. And we were getting ready to go on. The dressing room was behind the front curtain. So it was like the stage was right there. And this guy like pokes his head in, you know, pulls the curtain open and said, "Hey, I'm Paul Stanley of Kiss." And it's like, we're looking at him like, we didn't know what he looked like, because in those days, they never showed their faces.
Of course, yeah.
And so he said, I just want to let you guys know that George Harrison of the Beatles is in the front table. It was like, wow. I had like a narcolepsy attack. I just wanted to take a little nap. You know, I was just like so nervous. And we went out there and killed it. And then Paul came backstage afterward and said, hey, you know, we should try writing a song together. And jokingly, I said, okay, well, why don't you, you know, we were starting recording our first album. I said, why don't you write a song with us for our first album, which is we're doing now, and then I'll write a song with you. And he like looked at me kind of funny. Well, we co-wrote a song called The Fight, a song I had started with David Landau, John Landau's brother, who was our guitarist. And then it was his turn. So he said, okay, come to SIR. And they were rehearsing, their Kiss was rehearsing. So I walked in and there was a piano on the left-hand side of the stage with a big, heavy canvas cover. No need for a piano in Kiss, right? So he helped me pull the cover off. And then we sat together side by side and we started writing I Was Made for Loving You, which in the end, it was a very revolutionary song, because he was very influenced growing up with the sound of Motown. And so, you know, if you listen to I Was Made for Loving You, you can almost hear this, the feeling of standing in the shadow of love. You know, I was made for loving you, you know, standing in the shadow of love. And so, you know, we decided to try to put that Motown sound, you know, that dance beat, heavy dance beat with rock guitars. And nobody had done that before. And that opened the door to really the music that followed, you know, in the 80s, you know, from Prince and Madonna and Michael Jackson, Beat It, all of that. That happened because our song was so extraordinary and it was, you know, a hit all around the world. I recently found out that the only place it actually went to number one was Australia. How cool is that?
Yeah.
But it was, you know, number two, number three. It was in the top five everywhere in the world. And to this day, it's the most successful Kiss song of history.
It's incredible, isn't it? But I think it caused a bit of sorry.
And Gene Simmons hated the song.
To this yes, day. He did indeed. Tell us about then, Dan, because he said some not very nice things about it, hasn't he, over the years?
Yes. I mean, I think it was more like, you know, his shtick, like, having to have something to say in an interview. And so at one point he was, you know, he made an album produced by my great friend, Bob Ezrin, called The Elder. And so their whole thing was, because I was having all of this success with Bon Jovi and Aerosmith. And so he was looking at all the success and his shtick for that record was, we don't need collaborators. We don't need co-writers. In fact, we paid guards to stand at the door of the studio to keep Desmond Child out. And it was like, I read that and it's like, why would he slag the person that's put money in his pocket? You know, it was like, so, I mean, at that time, now I understand his humor and kind of think it's funny. But at that time, I was very hurt. So I called Paul up and I said, Paul, you know, this really bothers me. He said it like in 50 interviews all over the world. He said, why is he saying that? He says, you know, I can't control Gene. I mean, Gene, you know, says whatever he wants to say. I said, you know, well, tell him to go F himself, okay? And so later on that afternoon, I checked my answering machine. You know, we didn't have voicemail then.
Yeah.
And I heard like four words. Hi, it's Gene. Sorry. Click. And that was probably the only apology he ever gave in his entire life for anything.
So obviously you say now you know him better. I mean, obviously things are a lot better between you two in the last few years.
He's always very nice to me when I see him. He's like, you know, he's the kind of guy, he's very big, right? And so he, I'm almost 6 foot tall, but he towers over me. And, you know, who knows what kind of platform shoes are going on underneath that as well, right? But, you know, he's like, you know, he comes up, and when he talks to you, he gets up closer and closer and closer and closer, and he's right in your face, and he, you know, shakes my hand, like almost crushes it. And he says, "You're a very attractive and very talented young man." And then he'll walk away.
Brilliant stuff. But you obviously, you worked with Kiss again throughout the 80s, didn't you? The albums Animal Eyes and I think Asylum were a couple of the records you worked with. So how did you approach those ones?
Well, I didn't work with Kiss. I co-wrote with Paul Stanley. And Paul would bring his songs that he co-wrote with, you know, he co-wrote with various other co-writers. And I was one of his favorite. And he'd bring them to the table, and he'd usually get maybe half the record with songs he had collaborated on. And so that's how it happened. But, you know, I owe everything to Paul, because he's the one that introduced me to Bon Jovi. He's the one that opened the door and also taught me how to write stadium anthems the Kiss way, which is the protagonist can never be the victim. Always has to be the winner. The songs have to feel uplifting. And, you know, a lot of them are tongue in cheek, like Heaven's on Fire, which we co-wrote. And also, you know, the idea of writing songs that had opposites, you know, like Heaven's on Fire and Who Wants to Be Lonely, you know, like they have tension of opposites within the words, which then I applied to the song, the titles that I brought to my writing sessions with Bon Jovi. The very first song we wrote was You Give Love a Bad Name. And that was a title I had literally written on a little piece of paper in my back pocket. And it wasn't 5 minutes into meeting John and Richie. I pull it out and I say the title, and John's face lights up. I don't think I saw that many teeth in my lifetime. You know, this big smile, and we were off and running, and he threw down Shot Through the Heart, because he had a previous song called Shot Through the Heart, and none of us are, you know, waste a good hook, you know, so we'll just like recycle it into the next project, right? And so then, you know, Shot Through the Heart and You're to Blame, Darling, and then the three of us sang You Give Love a Bad Name. And that was our first, you know, three-way fist in the air collaboration.
Incredible stuff. You mentioned Paul introduced you to Bon Jovi. How did all that come about then?
Bon Jovi was one of the, you know, acts in the Kiss tour. And so they made friends, and, you know, Paul, you know, said, "Hey, why don't you try writing with this guy, Desmond?" And so he did. But I didn't know it until recently that they had no intention of writing with me for Bon Jovi. They had a plan to write with me, you know, like the idea was like the hit guy, the pop guy for other artists. And then that would bring money to their coffers so that they continue touring and all of that. But after writing You Give Love a Bad Name, they didn't want to let that song go. And then we went on to write Living on a Prayer and many other songs, Bad Medicine and, you know, Keep the Faith, and, you know, so many songs throughout the years.
Yeah.
And we've become very close, and especially with John, he's the godfather to my twin sons, Roman and Nero, who are now 21 years old.
Wow.
And he's a great godfather. You know, if anytime, you know, they ever got into trouble or anything, he would sit them down like a godfather from New Jersey does. And like set the record straight.
You're going to listen to John Bon Jovi, definitely. And you mentioned, obviously, the Living on a Prayer there. I mean, it's the name of the book. I'd read that you'd said it was your favorite song that you'd worked on as well. So tell me about how that one came about.
Well, that was the second time we got together to write. And we wrote in a borrowed apartment on this. I was playing this old rickety upright piano, grand piano, upright grand, you know, it was like this.
Yeah.
It you know, the keys were stuck, you know, half of them were gone. And they came in, Richie was on guitar, John brought his notebooks of lyrics, and he said he wanted to write a working class, you know, kind of tale about this, you know, couple that was having a really hard time making ends meet. And he didn't tell me at the time, but in his mind, he said he had in mind this couple from high school that he and Dorothea knew, Bonnie and Joe. And so I, on the other hand, you know, had my experience with Maria Vidal, who we, you know, had Desmond Child and Rouge together, and we lived in a one little room, you know, for 4 years together. And she, you know, while I wrote songs at home, she was working as a waitress in a diner called Once Upon a Stove. And her waitress name was Gina, because she reminded everyone of Gina Lola Brigida. She had black hair. She was very vivacious, very sexy. And so I threw in, you know, Johnny and Gina, because Johnny is my original name, John Charles Barrett, which I had changed in high school to Desmond Child. And so, you know, John said, I can't sing Johnny. That's my name. It's like, oh, right. And so we're all like looking off Johnny, and like somebody, I don't know who it was, said Tommy, because it was like a sound alike, maybe because John was thinking of Bonnie and Joe, right? So Tommy and Gina. And that's how Tommy and Gina were born.
Incredible. And it has become a literal anthem, hasn't it? It's one of those songs that have stood the test of time. And you go in a nightclub today and they'll still play it. It's just a huge, huge anthemic song.
I have a friend who's an astrophysicist who has a company that makes a kind of piece of equipment that's on the space station. And we met in Greece a few summers ago, and he engraved on this piece of equipment that measures all the radiation that gets inside the space station. And it says, halfway there, living on a prayer, with our initials on it. So we made it out into space. How cool is that?
That is very cool. Very cool indeed. Incredible stuff. Another band that you mentioned as well that kind of followed not long afterwards. In your book, John Colodner phoned you and says, very famous man himself, of course, he called you up and said that he wants you to write me a hit with The Assholes, a term of endearment for a certain group of, I don't know, American rock royalty. So explain that one for us.
Well, John Colodner, you know, had a very acerbic humor. And you know, he was very like, a negative person, but very lovable too. And so he, you know, he had Aerosmith, and he also had Cher. So, you know, Aerosmith was The Assholes, and then he called Cher shithead. And then later on, I found out from Steven Tyler that he called me faggot.
No.
This was when, you know, politically correct was not in fashion. And so, he is a brilliant man who, when, you know, when rock changed and, you know, music went way into urban and all of this, he just retired. He just, you know, he wasn't with it. He was just all about rock, a purist. And he really helped me a lot. And he imposed me on Steven Tyler and Joe Perry. So they did not want to co-write with an outside writer. I don't think they ever had, and it was always in-house. And so they fly me to Boston, and I think they thought they'd just meet me and then send me away. And so I walk into this warehouse where they were rehearsing their stage show and also, you know, recording and doing some stuff. And so the big, you know, doors open, this beam of light, you know, goes in through, and I'm like walking through the beam of light. Steven Tyler's like walking towards me with this big smile on his face. And he said, come with me. I mean, no introductions, no nothing. And Joe was working on a backwards guitar loop that went, na na, na na, na na. And then Steven started singing, cruising for the ladies. And it was like, you know, he did that. And then they said, what do you think of that? And I said, I think it's bad. And they looked at me like, bad? Yeah, just to kind of break the ice and be funny, because I say a lot of funny things. I don't think Van Halen would put that on the B-side of their worst record. And then Joe was like, you know, looking at me with his arms crossed like sideways. And then Stephen sheepishly said, well, when I first was singing that hook, I was singing Dude Looks Like a Lady. It's like, Dude Looks Like a Lady? That's a hit title. And Joe said, but we don't know what that means. And besides, we don't want to insult the gay community. I said, dude, I'm gay. I'm not insulted. And I said to Stephen, how did you, you know, come up with that title? He said, well, they were taking a break with the roadies and they went down by the shore and they walked into this, you know, almost empty bar at the end of this long bar, you know, all these stools was this vision of loveliness, this like big, you know, like platinum mullet with, you know, black nails and jewelry and this ivory skin, curvy figure. And they were all like drawing straws who was going to go up and say hello. So suddenly she turns around and it's Vince Neil of Motley Crue. And so then that's when Steven said, he said, ooh, that dude looks like a lady. That dude looks like a lady. Dude looks like a lady. Dude looks like a lady. And so when they went to write this, you know, to this loop, he started singing Dude Looks Like a Lady, I guess, or they immediately said, no, we can't sing that. So they changed the Cruising for the Ladies, which is the most generic, you know, thing. I mean, how many, you know, rock videos have we seen guys top down on Sunset Strip and the girls jump into the car? And, you know, it was like you just saw the whole thing. But they went along with what I suggested, which was let's write that story. Cruised into a bar on the shore, her picture graced the grime on the door. The idea that, you know, the guy, you know, goes in and he sees this gorgeous stripper and then he goes backstage and then she pulls out her gun and tries to blow him away. But he doesn't run away. He stays because he goes, my funky lady. I like it, like it, like it, like that. So how ahead of our times were we with that song? The second verse goes, never judge a book by its cover or who you gonna love by your lover. And it's like, it's the whole idea. It's like, if it looks good to you and you're drawn to it, go for it. And also to not judge it. And so I think we were way ahead of our time with that song.
Absolutely. And I think later on, Stephen and Joe both kind of, I don't know, downplayed your involvement somewhat in that song.
Well,
what was your feeling when that happened?
Well, it was opposite. Stephen, you know, spent three pages trying to say that the song was already written, you know, and, you know, that I just threw in a few little sprinkly little words and stuff. And it's like, and also did a portrait of me, you know, describing me, I look, you know, in his mind, I look like Juan Valdez of the coffee commercials, you know, with a big handlebar mustache. First of all, not even in the 70s porn era did I wear a handlebar mustache. You know, I've had beards, but never just like a Ted Lasso kind of mustache, and which that insulted me more than him saying that I hardly had anything to do with the song. And so, you know, then Joe made his book, collaborated with David Ritz, the one I did, you know, years before I wrote with David. And he said, well, Desmond came up with the title. And it's like, no, I didn't. That was Steven's title. So they both had, you know, one, you know, over praising me for coming up with the title, which I didn't. I just recognized that the title was a hit title. And so, you know, not that long ago, maybe a couple of years ago, Stephen made a country record and he had a song called Red, White, and You that one of my writers had written. So he came to my studio to sing the song and I sat him down. I said, look, let me talk to you about, you know, Dude Looks Like a Lady. And I went and I told him the whole entire story I just told you. And he's looking off in the distance and he goes, oh, I like your story better than mine. It's like, what? Now it's like forever in his book, wrong? You know, so I decided to set the record straight in my book.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you mentioned there, I mean, Joe being quite frosty with you. I'm guessing that's not the first time it's ever happened. So how do you deal with that? How do you face that when you come across someone like that?
Well, the following day, he didn't show up to the session. So I thought, oh my God, you know, he hates me. So luckily, Stephen showed up. No one was there. No rotors and nothing. This big cavernous, you know, warehouse. And at the, you know, at, in front of the stage, like down on the floor, you know, with against the stage was this little Wurlitzer piano. So he and I sat next to each other and I started asking him about his life. And he told me that he had, you know, struggled with substance abuse and had gone to rehab and was going to meetings. And that the person that got him through all of that was his beautiful new wife, Teresa. And so he kept saying, you know, well, she's an angel. You know, she's my angel. And it's like, angel? And then I saw those big blubber lips of his saying angel. And I started remembering Angie by the Rolling Stones and Mick Jagger going, Angie. You know, it's like he says Angie, but his lips keep fluttering, you know. And I said, oh, my God, he's got the same blubber lips. I have to write a song where he says Angie or angel like a million times, you know, so I can see those lips move the same way. I mean, that was like the crazy thought I had in my mind. So we wrote Angel, which was their next hit. And then the third day, Stephen didn't show up, but Joe did. And we wrote a song together called Hearts Done Time. So by now I was proving my worth. And so then, you know, eventually, you know, we became friends. But, you know, my secret was always...
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
Because I'm sort of like the palace eunuch. You know, let's say I'm writing with, you know, a band, you know, and then they go off to their AA meeting, see, but they leave me at the house with the wife, you know, making dinner. So, you know, I befriend the wife and then, you know, I start rearranging furniture, you know, straightening out the paintings, moving paintings, fluffing up the pillows, you know, doing all this stuff. And they know that they can trust me with their wives because, you know, I wasn't going to, like, you know, have an affair with them or something, right? So, you know, that's how I got inside. And, you know, if you're friendly and nice to the wife, you're in. Because pillow talk, you know, they go, you know, I really like that Desmond. You should invite him back. I need help with figuring out what I'm going to do with the den. You know, so I kept getting invited back.
Interior design is a good help. There you go.
you have to, whatever it takes.
Absolutely. And in your book, someone that you mentioned that you adored was Joan Jett. So what was she like to work with and why did she capture your imagination so much?
Well, Kenny Laguna saw, you know, the success I was having with these rock bands. And, you know, frankly, Joan hadn't had another hit after I Love Rock and Roll. And so, and now like 8 years had gone by. But that song was so strong. I mean, it fueled your tour and also her persona and, you know, everything about her was so extraordinary. She's so androgynous. I mean, she was, you know, had the face of like a female Elvis Presley, right? She was gorgeous, you know, and then her physique, like wide shoulders, muscular, boy hands, you know, and like this tough demeanor. You know, I always say I fell in love with the boy in her. You know, I mean, she's just got it. And her integrity is unbelievable. You know, she just never would do an endorsement for, you know, any product or instrument or anything. Like, she never sold out, you know, to anything. And she's, you know, done extraordinarily well. And so I had a title in my back pocket, I Hate Myself for Loving You, another title that had opposites, hate and love, right? And so she said, I'm not singing love. You know, I already have, I love rock and roll. I'm not going to sing another song with the word love in it. I said, yeah, but it has hate in it, you know, to balance it. And so finally, I convinced her to, well, just try it. And before we knew it, we had written the song. And, you know, I have the cassette tape of us writing that song together. Oh, it's wow. So cool. You know, at one point, one of the lyrics was, you know, something about the voodoo you do, I mean, that didn't make it into the song, but it's really amazing when you hear all the things you try in a song that you cast out, but they're still cool. And so, you know, I love Joan Jett, and we wrote a few other songs after that, you know, Get Off the Cross, I Need the Wood. I mean, we wrote some very cool songs. And you got a it's problem. Just, there was just, a song called You Got a Problem. You got a problem. You got a problem. I got a problem. Woo! You know, it's like really punky. And so I would love to work with her again. But one of the extraordinary things about this, you know, I Hate Myself for Loving You, it became the Monday night football theme. Then it's now continues to be the Sunday night football team. It was first recorded with Faith Hill, then Pink, and then Carrie Underwood. And then Carrie decided to write her own football theme. And they threw our song out. And then by public demand, you know, she was made to put it back. And recently, Dolly Parton recorded the song featuring Joan Jett on her new album, Rockstar. Yeah. So now I can add Dolly Parton to my list of celebrities, you know, celebrity legends that I've collaborated with.
Incredible list as well. Just I want to pick you up on something when you said you had it in your back pocket. You've mentioned it a couple of times. So do you and did you kind of always have ideas and did you always keep a note of them and they kind of came back up at different points and you go, oh, I've had that before or I've got something that might fit you perfectly. Is that the way you worked?
Well, I think sometimes it's the best way to walk into a session is to bring something that then, you know, either they like it or they don't like it. Usually the title has enough legs that they go, okay, well, let's see what happens. And before you know it, a well-written title, the song's already written. It's just built into the title. And so it eliminates all the millions of other possibilities. You know, it's just, they just blow away. And whatever suits the strengthening of that idea, that's what remains. And I learned that from my mentor, Bob Crew, who co-produced and produced the Four Seasons with Bob Gaudio. And at a certain point in his career, he took me under his wing, and only because I'm a Scorpio, because he, Bob Gaudio was Scorpio. Kenny Nolan is a Scorpio who co-wrote Lady Marmalade with him. And then me, it was like only Scorpios. You know, he was a Scorpio as well. So he only trusted Scorpios. And so I spent 2 years with him. We wrote 38 songs, but that was my college of songwriting because he wouldn't even begin to let me start even singing a note until we had a solid title to write to. So we could sit there all day long, just, you know, throwing words around until we finally came up with something. And so that was the kind of Brill Building, Broadway, discipline that I learned. Before that, even, you know, I had already had the hit with Kiss and everything. It's mumbling, you know, you play chords and mumble. And these days, you know, kids will put up a drum loop that has chords. So then they start rapping or singing to that drum loop that actually doesn't change. You know, they just keep doing variations on that same tone, which makes music very linear. And in the end, boring. Because it doesn't stand the test of time. It becomes like today's newspaper. It's not good tomorrow, you know? And so, you know, if the person is cool that's singing it and all that, that could give it legs, you know, if it's, you know, whoever it is, Kanye or, you know, The Weeknd or this or that. But The Weeknd, by the way, is a real, you know, amazing songwriter, you know, that has changes, chord changes. I mean, the guy's genius. I really would love to work with him sometime. That's my pitch. Weekend, call me. I'm free.
Fascinating. I love hearing all these stories and the way you come around stuff like that. It's brilliant. Someone else I'd like to touch on quickly, if you don't mind as well, Alice Cooper. Now, he was obviously a megastar, but he'd been through a dry patch as well in better ways of putting it, probably, but Trash, the album that you worked on him with, and Poison, the first big single. I think it was 12 years since he'd had a top 10 single, and then along came Poison, a huge hit. So how did you get involved with Alice, and how were you drafted in to help him with that?
Well, there was, I had a publisher, Deirdre O'Hara, and she was married to an A&R guy at Epic Records, Bob Pfeiffer, who had signed Alice Cooper. So they were looking for somebody to work with him. And so, you know, she put me in there. You know, the only thing I didn't realize was that Bob was a songwriter also. But there was a Sony ironclad rule that the A&R person could never co-write with the artist. They had to remain neutral so they wouldn't be choosing the songs they co-wrote. Yeah. You know, but anyway, he was, you know, insisting, you know, that he also be included as a songwriter and all that. And I said, absolutely not. So Alice and I basically wrote the entire record. I think there was a song he had written with Kip Winger previously that we recorded. I don't think I'm a co-writer on that, but almost all the songs were written almost like a theatrical piece, because he explained that Alice Cooper is really a character that he invented. And the way he got the name Alice Cooper was because his band was called Alice Cooper. They thought it was a cool, like, weird name. So people started calling him Alice. And so Alice has, you know, a history, a religious history. His father was a minister, a preacher. So the way he explained it, and he's very, you know, religious, a very spiritual person to this day. And he's a believer and belongs to a church and all this kind of stuff. I mean, can you imagine, you know, you look over and you go, what kind of church is this? Is this a coven? And so he said with Alice, if Alice cuts the head off a doll, you know, for shock value, he has to have his head cut off by the end of the show in the guillotine, which he still has in his show, right? So there's always a moral lesson. You can't be bad and survive. You know, you get punished. And so we wrote the songs this way. And so, you know, I brought every trick in the book to writing Trash, and also brought all the artists that I had been having success with, Aerosmith, Bon Jovi, Joan Jett. They all contributed to the album. And, you know, I think it was like kind of like a, what they call a barn raising, but it's more like, whatever, you know, set the barn on fire, whatever. In fact, there was a song called House of Fire that we had collaborated on with Joan Jett. And so that's how it all came to be. And, you know, still having a lot of problems with Bob. He didn't want me to attend the mixes. And the mixing guys, you know, said, we can't do this without Desmond. I mean, I had like 50 tracks that they didn't know what went where. So reluctantly, you know, this guy was very, like, always, you know, competitive and kind of seemed jealous of me and all that. So, you know, the song was great. And he went from selling 15,000 records to 4.5 million records, you know, with the record that we made and all the juice that we brought with it. He brought in Kip Winger, and Kip and I recently wrote a cool song called Proud Desperado, you know, the first time we ever co-wrote together. And in any case, when it came time for the next record, you know, I thought for sure I was going to be the producer. In fact, I had a different direction I wanted to take him in, because now we had already had, you know, Nine Inch Nails and, you know, the kind of the, you know, the start of this new kind of active rock. And a lot of it was electronic, rather than, you know, just guitars. And I wanted to make, and also Ozzy Osbourne was like, you know, in No More Tears, like very cool songs, you know? And so that's the direction I wanted to take them in. And Bob convinced them not to hire me. So then Bob co-produced the album with this British producer, Peter Coop, oh God, Collins, Peter Collins. And they started writing songs with Alice that were kind of like Desmond Child soundalikes with a lot of modulations on all this, but the songs, you know, it wasn't successful. And the label dropped him after selling 4.5 million records. Because that record only sold like 85,000 records. How do you go from 4.5 million to 85? And, you know, to this day, I still haven't been hired back. But we remain very good friends. And I love his wife, Cheryl. And a year and a half ago, I did an evening of my music at the Parthenon in Greece as a benefit for the Acropolis Museum with the, you know, hope of encouraging the return of the Elgin marbles, right? And because, you know, they're religious artifacts. It's not just artwork. That, you know, if you talk to any Greek person, they'll start crying when they say, you know, that it was stolen from them 200 years ago. So because my husband Curtis and I go there every year ever since our children were 5 years old to a little island called Folegandros. Every summer we just go there and stay there a month. We make a life for ourselves. That's a home for us. So I have a lot of sympathy for the Greek people. So Alice came and performed. So did Bonnie Tyler, one of my favorite artists. Rita Wilson, who's Greek, and the Rasmus from Finland. Yeah. And Kip Winger showed up. And all these great other musicians, Tabitha Fair, Chris Willis, Andreas Carlson, the great writer-producer from Sweden. He was in the backup line for backgrounds. And we had 18-piece all-female orchestra, and it was, you know, in this outdoor amphitheater with all this video mapping on the rocks behind. Every song had a different atmosphere and set. And you know, Alice, you know, you could see, you know, the power of Alice Cooper. He comes out, and the place went crazy. And he just held their attention, and he opened with Poison and then sang Bed of Nails, which is now in his show again, which is a song that was from Trash that had been forgotten. And people by popular demand started asking him to perform it. So, you know, he just, he took the, you know, that stage by storm. And so I finally understood that even though I had seen Alice before, being on the stage and seeing him from that perspective up close, you could see why he's the legend that he is.
Yeah, absolutely. And everyone always speaks really highly of him whenever I speak to anybody about Alice. I mean, what do you find when you worked with him? What's he like as a man?
He's just the sweetest and very intelligent, very articulate, has the funniest stories, the greatest sense of humor, loves to laugh. And I put some of his stories in the book. I can't reveal them here. They're not decent.
Absolutely. And just one last little collaboration, if you don't mind just talking about. So it's an interesting one. In My Dreams With You, Steve Vai, that from his album Sex and Religion. How did all that one come about?
Somehow we had collaborated together, and my manager and I became his managers. And along with our, you know, Ruta Sepetys, who was our office manager, and she ended up continuing to manage him for many years, you know, after I had left California. And, you know, I also art directed, you know, two of his albums, Sex and Religion, and then Alien Love Secrets or something. You know, it's like very cool because I love art direction and anything that has, remember, I told you I'm a great decorator.
Yeah.
But I'm good at art directing, you know, imagery and all of that. You know, people follow my Instagram, Desmond.child, you know, we work really hard on the graphics of that stuff. And I really enjoy it. If I wasn't a musician, I'd be an art director. I know, a graphic designer. I just love everything about words and print and pictures and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, we worked great. And Alice Cooper had given me a motorcycle. And, you know, Steve is a big motorcycle enthusiast. So I didn't know how to ride a motorcycle. And, you know, the gas tank had a, you know, Alice Cooper skull with the spider eyes. And it said demon.
Oh, very cool.
It said demon child on the side. I still have it, the gas tank. And so Steve Vai took me out, you know, to teach me how to ride a motorcycle. I almost killed myself. Like, I lost control of the bike very early on, rode up on somebody's yard. It looked like I was going 60 miles an hour into somebody's plate glass window. And at the last minute, I don't know how I did it, I stopped. I was able to stop it. And I was so frightened, I walked the motorcycle back. I killed myself, you know, like, you know, it's, you know, like, it was like four blocks. I walked it back, you know, so that's always a funny story with Steve Vai. But, you know, he's totally, you know, on another level, just spiritually. And, you know, his music, his musicianship is a virtuoso. And I had seen him early on with Frank Zappa when he was just a kid. And they had come down to Miami and they had performed in a small little club. And I remembered that him, you know, he was so striking. And then later on, it was amazing that we got to work together.
Fantastic stuff. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, Desmond. Just going to finish off quickly by saying that your book is wonderful. Definitely, I recommend people to go out and read it because
You mean this little thing?
That little thing indeed. Yes, that's the one. It's not all sweetness and light, though, because a certain Rod Stewart walked out of a couple of sessions, and I'm not going to spoil it. I'm going to tell people to go and read about that. But I'm going to leave off with five quick fire questions, if you don't mind, Desmond. Okay. The first one, do you take it personally if something that you've worked on doesn't become a hit?
No, I don't take it personally. I just step over the body and move on. I don't even bury the body. I just go to the next. Because it's unbearable, you know, failure is terrible. And if you let it get to you, you just stop. You go, well, why even bother? So I just, you know, disassociate. And I'm forward falling. I fail forwards.
That's a great line. Yeah, great line. And just, do you remember any that, or does any spring to mind that should have been a big hit, you think, that didn't actually make it?
Well, I co-wrote a song with John Bon Jovi, and then Richie later joined the song called You Want to Make a Memory. And I think it did make it to number one on the AOR chart. But, you know, it was, you know, I wasn't the producer of it, and they produced it in a kind of linear way, you know, almost like With or Without You or something like that. Okay. And I felt it didn't really sound like Bon Jovi, you know, to me. I would have produced it way more aggressively. And I performed the song in my show and everything. It's that song is such a great song. You know, I felt it deserved, you know, more. And so, you know, that was a song where, you know, it still made it to number one, but still, you know, I wanted it to be number one in the pop charts. And it's such a great written song, you know, so, you know, that was a little bit of a disappointment. But I sound spoiled because it still made it to number one. But you know, I had a different vision of it in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. With your resume, that's absolutely fine. Question two, was there anybody that you weren't keen to work with and you kind of got put with them, but they ended up surprising you in a good way?
I don't know. I can't think of somebody I wasn't keen to work with. I just, you know, more like I'm keen to work with everybody and some people, you know, the chemistry isn't there. It's more like that. And usually they don't come back. And that's okay. You know, I would have loved to have written more with Katy Perry. And there was no problem with her. And, you know, we co-wrote with Andreas Carlson, Waking Up in Vegas, which was a number one record. But through the years, you know, I never got put with her again. And I wish we had worked more together.
Kind of similar question then. Is there anyone that you had maybe a big falling out with during a writing session or a recording session and refused to work with them again?
Not really. You know, I've written with a country artist, let's say. I wasn't even an artist. He was like a hit songwriter that had like 4 number ones. And then he comes to the session and he's all the time getting up, going to his phone to talk to his manager. And so I'm sitting with, you know, the late, you know, great Andrew Dorf, who's a very shy person. And they're up in my house and the guy is walking out, walking in, walking out. And finally I said, you know what? You have to put away your phone. You know, I can't work with you. You know, it's like, this is very disrespectful and you need to stop and give us the time that you said you were going to work with us. And he got so pissed, he left. You know, I mean, but I'm, you know, the guy was young and, you know, I'm kind of a mentor type. You know, I'm a teacher. I had great mentors and very strict teachers. Bob Crew was a very strict teacher, you know, that would chain me to the piano. And, it's like that, you know, this whole like idea that somehow your time has no value. And I don't abide by that. The point is that when it's time to write, phones shut off. And you're only in the here and now. You can only write in the here and now, anything of merit. So, you know, that idea of that ADD idea of like, oh, I can multitask, you know, I can drive and text and my baby's in the back. Really? You know, it's not, you know, to me, it's so exhilarating when people in this creative circle just surrender to each other and we can go to a higher level, create something that's never been heard before, not just recycle that person's last hit because that person thinks that's the only thing their fans will ever want to listen to, right? There's stories like that, you know, that Alana Miles story is pretty wild in the book. But that's the whole thing. It's more like that. Modern day kids are so distracted. And so, you know, for them to buckle down and be willing to work through a weekend, to work all night, whatever it takes to make a hit, you know, that's the kind of work ethic that I promote and encourage. And so many people, you know, that have worked with me have come up to me and said, you know, it was that time that I wrote with you that reset my mind, you know, and got me to buckle down and become successful. So that always is a great, great feeling.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. And one other question then kind of goes along the lines of great feelings. Is there any sessions, if you could go back and relive one session or writing session or recording session, what would it be? Is the one that stands out the most to you?
Oh, gosh. Maybe it was working with Bonnie Tyler. And okay. We had decided at the last minute to do a Janis Joplin song that she had done on her first Big Brother album called Turtle Blues. You know, I'm a mean woman, baby. And we end the record with it. And we were at Bearswell Studios where Janis had recorded when she had, you know, had since passed. And I went into the vocal booth with her and she starts channeling Janis. And the two of us looked at each other and we were like goosebumpy. I'll never forget that moment. And, you know, that's a wonderful record, by the way. Hide Your Heart is the name of the album. And I had found a song for her that had never been recorded before and begged the writers, Holly Knight and Mike Chapman, to let me have it. Because remember, she had had Total Eclipse of the Heart. So she was poised to have another huge hit. And the song goes like this. You're simply the best, better than all the rest. And the label told us we didn't have any hits on the record. And, you know, the guy, the A&R guy, Muff Winwood, right? Steve Winwood's brother was the head of A&R. And there were so many hits on this record. They gave me a budget for 3 songs. I cut 10 songs. Borrowed from, you know, Peter to pay Paul to make that record happen because I love Bonnie so much. And, you know, they didn't hear the best. It should have been the first single. And so they completely like neglected her. I mean, her career never recovered. And, you know, it was very, very painful. Then a year and a half later, Tina Turner cuts it. It becomes the biggest song in the world to this day. So there you have it. You know, and Tina's version is the exact duplicate of Bonnie's version. Same synths, same, wow. You know, you got A and B them. They're like identical. So, you know, these A&R, you know, geniuses aren't so genius sometimes.
Sliding doors moments. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, Desmond. And again, I recommend everyone to go out and get Living on a Prayer, Big Songs, Big Life. It's an absolutely fascinating read. It's not just about rock and roll. There's everything in there because you've worked with so many other superstars as well from the pop world and the Latino world and everything else, plus all the in-depth stories about you and your life and your personal life and everything you've gone through. It's an incredible read. So please do get out and buy it. And Desmond, thank you so much for joining me on VIP Rocks today.
Thank you, Paul. You've been wonderful to talk to. Thank you.
There you go, the brilliant Desmond Child. I hope you enjoyed listening to those stories of rock legends and some of the classic songs that he's been involved with. Remember, you can read even more about all these and more in his new book, which is called Living on a Prayer, Big Songs, Big Life, which is out now. And so that's it for me in this week's episode then. Thanks again for listening. Make sure you subscribe to VRP Rocks on your podcast apps so you get all the episodes, loads more great guests and brilliant stories to come over the next few weeks. Please leave VRP Rocks a 5-star review on that podcast app that you're using right now. A really big difference it makes, it does. Check out VRP Rocks on YouTube as well. The channel growing all the time. Give us a like, a follow, subscribe, whatever it is on the social media channels too. Just search for VRP Rocks everywhere. A big thanks to all of you who interact each week. I'll get some more right out next week for you as well. So until then, take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.